Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with John Borer about his new book, The Revolution of Robert Kennedy, From Power to Protest After JFK. Jack, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks, Mark.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Okay, I'm 33 years old. I live in New York City. I'm a television producer on a night shift on a TV news cable program. And I've worked on this book mostly at the New York Public Library for the last 4 years. I went to Washington College in Chestertown, Maryland, and spent some time as a speechwriter. And then I got into writing, did some journalism. I ended up in television news, and that's what I do now.
What was it that led you to write this book? What was it that engaged you about the topic where you're spending all this time at the New York Public Library going through archives, going through books to write it?
Well, I found Robert Kennedy very interesting in college. I wrote my senior thesis in college about Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Cesar Chavez in 1968. But when I was doing that research, I got very intrigued by these two young men who worked for Bobby Kennedy when he went into the Senate. Their names were Adam Alinsky and Peter Edelman. They were about 27 and 28 years old. They were mid-level Justice Department lawyers. They both worked for assistant attorneys general. And they were of no particular importance. And it was interesting because Robert Kennedy was the brother of the slain president. He had been the closest to power without actually being president in the United States. It's kind of as if someone like Hillary Clinton had hired just these random young men. So I wanted to write a book about those guys. And as I did the research about them and started writing, I noticed that they really were just part of Robert Kennedy's story, that Bobby was the constant throughout of it. And in writing about them in 1964 and 1965, when they joined the campaign in 64 and the 1965, going into the Senate, I sort of began to see that there was this middle point of Robert Kennedy's post-JFK life that really did not get the attention I felt it deserved. And it makes sense in some ways because the Kennedy White House and the 1968 campaign were these two giant events in his life. They're these mountains. And in between that is this valley where he makes this journey between those two places. And I think in that time period, you can really see how Robert Kennedy became the person he was at the end of his life and really began to find his own voice and political independence. And so that's really what drew me into writing about this particular period, because it is, in some ways, it's different from most other Kennedy books because it's only focusing on from November to 1963 to June of 1966.
The title of the book is The Revolution of Robert Kennedy, and it's a very interesting word that has multiple meanings. I'm wondering, in what sense is this period the revolution that you describe it?
So the Revolution of Robert Kennedy describes what Robert Kennedy underwent, and also it makes allusion to something that Robert Kennedy wrote about in the weeks after the assassination and something he spoke about when he went to South Africa in 1966 and gave his Day of Affirmation address to the students who were fighting apartheid. In JFK's inaugural address, right before he says, "Let the word go forth," he makes this allusion to the heirs to the revolution. We dare not forget that we are the heirs to that first revolution. And Robert Kennedy wrote about that when he was writing his memorial edition of the Profiles in Courage foreword. The foreword to the memorial edition of Profiles in Courage. And in that writing, he wrote about change, and he wrote about things that you really couldn't imagine happening. And this is something that Robert Kennedy faced as he began his new life of how do I adjust to not having a direction? And later, when he goes to the Senate, after he is turned down for the vice presidency, which he really tried hard to achieve, with Lyndon Johnson. He then went to speak at college campuses, and he told these students about this thing called the Revolution Now in Progress. And in doing so, he talked about the rapidity of change, that for a time the difference between travel was walking and riding a horse, and that as they sat in Queens College or in Plattsburgh or in the University of Buffalo, there were two men orbiting the Earth. And this is a change from, 60 years earlier, where they had just invented flight. So he was saying, you're going to live through the rest of the third of the 20th century. And in doing so, you're going to see even more change, and you have to be prepared for change. And really, the world is undergoing all of these revolutions, and you're going to need to have a worldwide youth movement that works together to make sure that's a peaceful one, that it's a just one. And that really becomes his message as he goes around the world, as he goes around the country. He talks to students in Oxford, Mississippi, about the changes that are going on with civil rights. He goes to California and talks about free speech and talks about dissent. He goes to South America and talks to students who are literally in the midst of actual revolutions, where democracy is still fragile in some places. He goes to South Africa, where these brave students are standing up against a racist and oppressive government, and says, you're going to stand up, and by doing so, just this tiny act, you can change the world. And that really is, that's the other revolution about Robert Kennedy.
It really is a dramatic transformation, considering the Robert Kennedy that you introduced the reader to at the start of the book, because you describe at the beginning a man whose career is very much a adjunct to his brother Jack's career. And that really comes across, especially when you describe how dramatically John Kennedy's death transforms Robert's political position, because he is, on the most basic level, he's just incredibly grief-stricken. And you describe how he is coping with that grief over a period of months. In some respects, never really gets over it. But at the same time, there is this shift that really illustrates the degree to which Robert Kennedy's political career was very much in support of his brother's political career, and how all of a sudden he finds himself unmoored.
Right. So Robert Kennedy basically took most of the direction of his adult life from his brother and from family. In 1952, he doesn't attend his law school graduation because he has to go to Massachusetts to help run Jack's Senate campaign. In 1956, he drops everything to go work on Adlai Stevenson's losing presidential campaign so that he can learn the inner workings of a national organization for Jack's effort 4 years later. In 1960, they said that no one worked harder than Robert Kennedy around the clock on that race, and that he put everything he had into it. And even after the 1960 election, where he thought that he might not go into government, that he might do something else for once, his father, Joseph P. Kennedy, impressed upon him and JFK that he needed Bobby in the cabinet. He needed him to be one of his closest advisors, because JFK needed someone who was going to be absolutely blunt with him, who had no angle, whose motives were never questionable, who could keep him on the right path. And that's really what Bobby Kennedy did. He tried to protect JFK at all costs. And so even at the end of JFK's life, Robert Kennedy was thinking about how to best protect him. They were beginning to plan the 1964 campaign, and Robert Kennedy felt that he was becoming too politically toxic to even be a part of the administration or the campaign, that people who had grievances against him for civil rights, whether they be upset that he wasn't pushing hard enough or upset that he was, quote-unquote, cramming it down their throats, that they were starting to put it from just me to the Kennedy brothers. So he was having conversations about leaving. And then on November 22nd, the president was killed, and Robert Kennedy's world was turned upside down. So he had to start thinking about the future, which had before seemed very certain and set. And in that case, he really didn't know what to do. He was left. He was left basically concerned that the Kennedy legacy wouldn't mean much at the time. He was telling people in November and December of 1963 to get what they wanted now, because our power will last for just 11 months. It will disappear on election day, 1964. And while that was a wrong assessment of the situation, that actually the Kennedy name and that the sentiment for JFK would stretch a lot longer and went a lot deeper than that, as he would soon see from how people reacted to him. He felt that the best way he could go about keeping the Kennedy legacy alive was to seek the vice presidency with Lyndon Johnson.
You described,
and that's really where that's the first sort of leg of his journey beyond the new frontier.
It's an understandable assumption of his, given what you describe happens soon after his brother's assassination. You describe how Kennedy had a phone on his desk that was connected directly to J. Edgar Hoover. And basically, you know, it was almost like the moment after President Kennedy's dead, Hoover no longer answers that phone. And how,
yeah, he goes to Florida, and when he comes back, the line's no longer there. And he says, these people don't work for us anymore.
And then you go from having an attorney general who has, as you describe, daily access to the president and goes in there, not just on official business, but of course in his role as an advisor. And now all of a sudden that avenue is closed as well. So in terms of what was happening to his individual position, it must have seemed as though the power was rapidly fading away, and he was having to undergo this dramatic reassessment. Now, you describe that he has this quest for the vice presidency, and you explain throughout much of the first part of the book why it was that he sought what was a position that, ironically enough, his predecessor was chafing at in terms of its impotency, and his predecessor being Lyndon Johnson, of course, and at the same time, how it really does seem to serve for Robert Kennedy and for many other people as this important example or demonstration of the endurance of that legacy.
Well, Robert Kennedy, like I said, thought that the Kennedy name wasn't going to mean much. And then he starts to go out and see people, and you know, he knows that it's a monumental thing, the president's assassination, that it's really hanging over all of the country for a very long time. But he goes to speak to the United Auto Workers in February of 1964. And he's just enveloped by the crowd. There are these people who are just pushing for him to shake his hand, to tell him something. And before, people had gone to him as a person who had the ear of the president, and they had reached out to JFK through him in that way to get a message through. But now they were reaching out to JFK, but to Bobby. And it was a different sort of feeling. It was a different kind of power that he had never really felt before. And as he kept going along, speaking to the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick in Scranton, Pennsylvania on St. Patrick's Day in 1964, his first real political speech after the New Frontier, he can sense that there's this thing they're looking at. The writers of the Scranton Times wrote about how people, how he was looking past the people as if he saw a ghost, that he looked like, he understood, and he would tell people that, it's not for me, it's for him, as him being JFK. That they would see him talking to himself, his lips moving, And Kenny O'Donnell would say, you know, later I thought he was talking to himself. Later I realized he was talking to Jack. So there was that thing in the back of his mind at all times that, you know, I was asked whether who he looked to for inspiration after Kennedy's assassination, his brother's assassination. And the person he really looked to for inspiration was JFK. You know, he looked to JFK's bravery, his courage, through all of his sort of medical trials and his suffering. He said that JFK never, you know, let people know that only the people who were closest to him knew, because they could tell his, you know, his face was a little whiter, his words were a little sharper, but those who didn't know him well detected nothing. And so that kind of bravery, that kind of bravery influenced how he was going to go forward. And the legacy that he at first wanted to carry out was to make sure that civil rights was done. And the civil rights bill that JFK had called for on June 11, 1963, and that Lyndon Johnson also took up as a tribute to JFK. But he was slightly resentful that Lyndon Johnson got a lot of credit for things that he felt were Kennedy initiatives, like the immigration bill that eventually passed in 1965, and some of the stuff with education. And for the most part, that he and people like Arthur Schlesinger resented the talk about Lyndon Johnson's legislative genius, because they were saying, well, if you think even one time that Schlesinger talked about the alternative, had JFK been the vice president and Johnson been the president at the time, and Johnson been assassinated and JFK had inherited this enormous feeling from the country, and then a challenger like Goldwater and defeated him handily, how he would have operated in Congress in 1965 in the 89th Congress, and whether he would have been viewed as this masterful legislative genius.
And that gets to this key dynamic in 1964 that you write about, which is the relationship between Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, and how you have, on the one hand, Robert Kennedy seeking to become vice president, as you've described, but he's seeking to do so with a man with whom he has had a famously troubled relationship, and one who doesn't just see Robert Kennedy as Robert Kennedy, but sees him as almost an avatar of, you know, capital K Kennedyism, and mm-hmm. you're getting into that relationship there.
Yeah, you know, Lyndon Johnson resented Robert Kennedy almost from the beginning. I don't know as much, I haven't done the personal research on their relationship before the presidential campaign of 1960, but from everything I have read about 1960, Johnson thought RFK was always trying to get rid of him, and that he just flat out didn't like him. Now, fast forward to 1963, when Johnson is suddenly president and RFK is attorney general. Bobby's considering resigning because he's not sure that he's wanted in the Johnson administration, and he's not sure that he wants to be a part of it. Johnson persuades Clark Clifford, the Washington fixer, to have a long conversation with Bobby, and they speak for 2 hours in early December 1963, and Bobby agrees to stay for the time being. Johnson decides that he has to clear up some points of misunderstanding about things related to the assassination and related to the transition of power. Related to the assassination is in how Jacqueline Kennedy was treated on the plane back from Dallas, and related to the transition is in how President Kennedy's personal items were treated in the White House. Then a few weeks later, Bobby Kennedy sits and thinks, and then he decides that he's just done thinking about the future, and he's just going to serve out as his term as Attorney General, which he tells Anthony Lewis of the New York Times in early January of 1964. Their relationship then becomes quite interesting. Bobby's attending a National Security Council meeting when Johnson turns to him and asks if he can take care of a situation in Southeast Asia. Bob's sort of surprised by this, and the room is actually kind of happy to see him weigh in, and they all encourage him to go on this foreign trip. Now, on this foreign trip, Johnson interprets some of the coverage of it as helping Robert Kennedy as a vice presidential candidate. And so when Robert Kennedy returns, Johnson is very cool to him. And it kind of seesaws like that throughout the rest of 1964, in which Johnson is angry with something Kennedy has done that he feels is trying to influence him in his choice for vice president. And Kennedy is every now and then offended by how Johnson is treating him or treating other people who would serve President Kennedy. And that kind of becomes the power dynamic between the two of them. Johnson always has the upper hand, and Kennedy is trying to ingratiate himself because, as Kennedy doesn't know what he wants to do, he settles upon the vice presidency as his sort of duty. And that's kind of where the book goes.
And as you make clear, as much as Johnson may have had issues with Robert Kennedy, he realizes that he can't dismiss Kennedy or demean him in any way that he might want to, because ultimately that would not hurt him. He was savvy enough to realize, as much as he may have disliked Robert Kennedy, he needed to have some sort of at least publicly positive relationship with the Kennedy aura, if you will.
Absolutely. There were times when he was very close to anger, to boiling over in his anger, I should say, that he wanted to fire Robert Kennedy. There is a tape that I was able to unseal and report for the first time in this book, in which Lyndon Johnson is talking to his aide, Bill Moyers, on the night before the New Hampshire primary in 1964. And he says, well, we could ask him to resign. And there's a pause, and Bill Moyers says, that won't do any good. And he said, Johnson says, well, I don't know how he'd feel without all that, his people around him, and without all that power. Now, it's kind of like listening to Donald Trump be talked down from a tweet. And Bill Moyers does it excellently. I think Johnson knew he wasn't that self-destructive that he couldn't just fire the brother of the slain president and then expect to not have some political fallout. Robert Kennedy had a lot of support among very powerful northern political bosses who had still a lot of power at the Democratic National Convention. And remember that this is before the 25th Amendment has been ratified. So the vice presidency is vacant, and it cannot be filled constitutionally without the next election. And that this is before the primary and caucus process is strengthened, so that all of the power really rests with the political powers in the states and the convention delegations. So Johnson had to keep things on an even keel for the time being, and that required keeping some of his anger that was directed towards Bobby to himself or to his close associates. And meanwhile, Robert Kennedy had a lot of ill will and ill feeling towards Johnson, but he was constantly trying to prove to him that he could be loyal and that he could serve in the same sort of capacity that LBJ served JFK. Though I think had Robert Kennedy been successful in his plans, he would probably be remembered a lot more like Hubert Humphrey today than maybe Robert Kennedy, in that he wouldn't have had the sort of independence that he eventually did gain.
You describe how the matter was ultimately decided, and it was this very arguably clever move on part of Lyndon Johnson, where he doesn't say Robert Kennedy is not going to be my vice presidential nominee. Instead, he makes a very different statement. I was wondering if you could describe that statement.
Yeah. So in the summer of 1964, we're entering the final push for the convention, which was in the end of August of 1964. And so in July, Lyndon Johnson decides that he has to do something before the convention, and well before the convention, because he was worried that if things got there, he couldn't control it, there was going to be a tribute to JFK, and they, the President Johnson's forces moved it to after the nominations because they didn't want that that emotional movie played and then emotional speeches made and then Robert Kennedy's name entered into the roll call and then a demonstration taking him, sweeping him into the vice presidential nomination or even perhaps the presidential nomination in Johnson's worst nightmare. And actually when they do move it, and the columnist Mary McGrory writes about it as a, as what it was, you know, a move to stymie Robert Kennedy's vice presidential hopes, Johnson says to his aide Cliff Carter, you know, how did McGrory find out about her plan? And so he makes the decision to tell Robert Kennedy that you're not going to be the vice presidential nominee. He calls Bobby on a Monday. He tells him to come by the White House. Robert Kennedy actually stalls for 2 days. And when he finally brings him in, he reads him a statement. And he just reads from the beginning for the first few minutes of the conversation. And it's his explanation, and basically he's saying that I'm only making the same sort of choice that JFK would have made, and I want the same sort of freedom, and you know, this is what I need to do. So he tries to get Bobby to make the announcement himself. He basically asks Robert Kennedy to withdraw his name from contention, and Robert Kennedy is insulted by this and says, "No, he has to do his own." He has to take out his own trash, essentially. And yeah, there's this sort of standoff, and Johnson is getting really nervous, and he's calling Democratic leaders in Pennsylvania. He's calling people in Chicago. He calls Mayor Richard Daley in Chicago and says, you know, if you could tell somebody from the wire services that President Johnson should have his choice as vice president, and only his choice as vice president, I would, you know, mightily appreciate it. Make sure no one attaches your name to it. And he's really sweating this decision. And meanwhile, Ted Kennedy, who has a broken back and is laid up in a hospital in Boston, says that I have one choice for vice president, and he's my brother. And this is just making Johnson turn white. And so he comes up with an idea to eliminate all members of the cabinet and people who regularly meet with the cabinet from vice presidential contention. So this actually does take out a few people who were considered themselves to be contenders, like Sergeant Shriver, Robert Kennedy's brother-in-law. And so President Johnson quickly goes about and calling people. He calls Robert McNamara and lets him know, hey, you're not going to be vice president. And McNamara laughs on the tape recording. Say, okay. And after he makes all these quick phone calls, he had a press conference earlier in the day, a little press meeting with reporters. So they abruptly asked for them to come back, and he comes in, reads off this statement, in which Robert Kennedy is the third on the list. I think Secretary of State Dean Rusk, who was no one's idea of a political candidate, was first on the list of people he was eliminating from vice presidential contention. And it's immediately seen for what it is that it was taking Bobby's name out of the running. And Robert Kennedy jokes, you know, about taking so many good people over the side with him. And he says, you know, I'm sorry to see Dean Rusk won't be, you know, the vice presidential nominee. it was clearly a farce, but it did the job. I mean, Robert Kennedy really couldn't fight that, and he did have a plan to fight it. You know, he wanted to. He had told the pollster Lou Harris in the time that he was stalling that that he believed that Lyndon Johnson needed him to perform well in the urban areas, and especially with this kind of Catholic backlash vote to civil rights, he felt. And that Johnson also really didn't understand how to run a national campaign, and that so he could resign as attorney general, serve as campaign manager, and I think he felt that in that month between the end of July and the end of August when the convention was, he was going to show a lot of the people who were skeptical of him, because people still really didn't trust him. I mean, there's this whole other issue about the ruthlessness and about the political hatchet man he had been for his brother. that he could be vice president and he could be a good choice and a winning choice. And that was really what he believed. And when Johnson gave him the statement that you're not going to be vice president, Bobby didn't fight him. And he probably could have. He said, well, you didn't ask me. And in some cases, people interpreted those words as a joke, as a wry joke. But, in other depictions, people depicted those words as kind of sad. But I think Robert Kennedy realized, listening to Lyndon Johnson talk in their conversation about some of his aides, Lyndon Johnson talked about the people who worked for him as not being that great. And Bobby thought that this man is not loyal to the people who have been loyal to him. So how could I be loyal to him? And I think that was really a turning point for him as well, because, that was one of the things he valued most, and that was what he valued with JFK.
It doesn't seem, though, that Kennedy appreciated Johnson's need to demonstrate that he could win the presidency on his own. You quote Johnson making that point in the book, which is that if Johnson had Kennedy on the ticket, there would always be this sense that the only reason why Johnson won was because he had a Kennedy on his ticket, that he could never have won in his own right because he was just, a Texan from the South, and the South still had a bit of that stigma as when it came to national politics. So, but at the same time, as you point out, in a way, Johnson does Kennedy a favor. He gives Kennedy that push that Kennedy needs. And granted, it's a risky push because there's no guarantee that Kennedy is going to win public office anytime soon, especially given the dearth of options that were available to him in 1964.
Yeah, and so at first, throughout 1964, they hadn't just looked at the vice presidency. They were practical. They looked at Massachusetts and found that it was really Ted Kennedy's state, and he didn't want to go there and encroach on that. And in New York, he could consider running for governor, but they discovered that there was a 5-year residency requirement. And so really the nearest opportunity was the Senate race in 1964.
Well, they also had to rely on Virginia, even though Robert Kennedy was currently living there too.
Virginia wasn't even on the table because of it was really the old Dominion then, and he was not popular in Virginia, and that was still the Byrd machine was there, that wasn't going to fly, even though he lived in Virginia and voted in Massachusetts. So his brother-in-law Steve Smith really took over the operation of organizing the New York Senate race and having it be a viable thing for him to jump into when he was ready. Now, when Ted Kennedy's plane crashed in June of 1964, Robert Kennedy goes to the hospital. It's actually in Western Massachusetts where the plane went down. And at first it wasn't clear whether or not Ted Kennedy would live. And once it was, he had been so shaken by this that he removed himself from contention from the New York Senate race, though he did not remove himself from contention for the vice presidency, though he could have done that just as easily. And so when he is finally eliminated from the vice presidency, he kind of goes off for the weekend to think of, what am I going to do now? I don't think there's anything left for me in this town, is what he is quoted as saying to a friend in Time magazine. And he decides to make the race in New York. And he goes in, he gets the blessing of the mayor, Robert Wagner, who is the most powerful Democrat in the state at that point, because there was a Republican governor and two Republican senators, Jacob Javits and Kenneth Keating, who Robert Kennedy ran against. He gets the nomination pretty easily. It's a convention nomination. He then begins his campaign, and it's difficult because he's not a great speaker, though he had taken speech lessons in the winter of 1964 as part of his preparation for what was coming next of political leadership. And he's just mobbed by these crowds everywhere he goes. He's overscheduled. His hands are swollen and bleeding. And he doesn't really have a clear message. He goes and speaks, and no one can really hear him for all the screaming. He's treated like a beetle. And so slowly over time, he finds his connection. His real connection is doing question and answer sessions with students and young people, and not really giving this sort of pat speech of these are the 10 reasons why you should vote for me. He wants to have a conversation, a colloquy with people. And Robert Kennedy then is benefiting completely from the collapse of the Republican Party. His opponent, Kenneth Keating, does not endorse the presidential nominee, Barry Goldwater, in 1964. And there are some independents and Democrats who break off from the sort of liberal angle and go with Keating, who had a moderate to liberal record. And in the end, he's carried through, though, by substantially less votes than Lyndon Johnson gets in the state.
Given what follows, it really does seem that the Senate race is where Robert Kennedy begins to find himself politically, because the scenes you describe of him connecting with students, engaging in questions and answer sessions, that seems to be a format that he returns to later on when he goes to Latin America, when he goes to South Africa. He's beginning to discover where his strengths are, where he works best during the Senate campaign. And as you describe, it's not without a fault. I mean, while Kennedy won, it wasn't a sure thing. Kenneth Keating was popular. Kennedy had to overcome the stigma of being sort of a carpetbagger. As you point out, and I must confess, I didn't know this until I read the book. Robert Kennedy couldn't even vote for himself because he couldn't. He wouldn't have been eligible until 1965. So he's
right. Running. He was only eligible to vote in Massachusetts. So he and Ethel opted not to vote at all. Though, because I guess they could have voted in Massachusetts, and it's kind of in some ways poetic because the last president he voted for was JFK. He wasn't able to vote. And then actually in 1965, when he goes to vote in the general election in the mayoral race, the local Republican councilman challenges him and Ethel as not citizens of the state, and they have to sign an affidavit to fill out their ballots. So,
And that kind of thing did matter to a lot of older voters, because a lot of these young people who were mobbing Robert Kennedy were not old enough to vote. The voting age was still 21, and a lot of those people were, the crowds were impressive, but you describe how, a lot of his campaign aides realized that didn't necessarily translate into an automatic victory.
Yeah, there was one anecdote that I think Gerald Gardner gave, who is a comedian / speechwriter for Robert Kennedy in that race, who said that when Kenneth Keating was told there were something like 50,000 people on the streets of Buffalo for Bobby Kennedy, he said, "Were they all adults?" His big challenge in convincing people that he wasn't for real, that he wasn't some gimmick too, that people wanted to just see this icon being paraded through the streets, who looked like and sounded like the slain president. And there were real questions about whether or not he really believed in liberalism, because he was viewed as a person to kind of touch back on what Robert Kennedy was before he became the Robert Kennedy we remember. He was ruthless. He was the person who was the political operator. He was conniving and brutish, and people thought that he put votes over principles, and that he was that he would sell people out and just do the politically expedient thing, that he was too calculating and opportunistic. And I mean, opportunistic in just the fact that he went to New York to run for the Senate. They would call him the vice presidential reject. This really hung over him for a long time. And honestly, it's tough to say whether or not Robert Kennedy could have won that race in a different time, in a different climate, when I think LBJ won New York State by 2 million votes and Bobby won it by, I think, a little more than half a million. It was something like 600,000 votes, if I recall correctly.
I think he was the only Democrat. Yeah. I think he was the only Democrat elected between Herbert Lehman in, I think it was 52, and Moynihan in 78. So you're talking about a period.
It might have been Averill Harriman, I think.
No, Harriman was
the last one.
Harriman was governor. I'm talking about the Senate.
Senate.
So during the
There was this drought for Democrats. It was I read somewhere. I'm not sure this is actually accurate that New York had been second to Kansas in electing Democrats statewide for that period, which was a boom period for Democrats around the country. But absolutely. And then they started losing the mayoral races too.
But Kennedy wins. And he enters the Senate, and it's a really interesting environment because on the one hand, he is at the bottom of the totem pole. I mean, it's fascinating how he's introduced into the Senate by his younger brother. You describe how it's a complete reversal, a revolution, if you will, of the dynamic that has existed in their entire lives. And how in a chamber where seniority is the currency of choice, you know, Robert Kennedy's at the bottom, and yet at the same point in time, he's Robert Kennedy, and that doesn't go away just because he's in the United States Senate.
It's a change for not just the person Robert Kennedy, but also sort of the Senate as an institution. And so, yeah, Robert Kennedy's elected. His younger brother, who's 7 years younger than him, who had tagged along with his friends to the beach when he was a prep school student and Robert Kennedy was in college, was suddenly Bobby Shepard in this institution where, frankly, Teddy was much more suited to thrive than Bobby was. Teddy was collegial. He would drink bourbon with the chairman. He didn't have also the relationship that Bobby had with them before, in which, you know, Robert Kennedy had to learn how to call them by their first names, and he would sometimes flub their names, like Maureen Neuberger from Oregon. He called her Marion a few times. I mean, he he's quoted the newspapers doing so as well, unfortunately. So there was that to begin with, that, you know, he's going from the executive branch to the legislative branch. He's 99th in seniority out of 100. And he's also a celebrity who has basically newspaper articles written about him almost every day. He's one of the most watched people on the planet. And so, and this is just in the beginning of how he begins to even change some of the traditions in the Senate. When Ted Kennedy went to the Senate, he waited, I think it was something along the lines of 18 months before he gave a speech, his maiden speech. JFK is something similar along those lines of a year or so. Robert Kennedy gets up and speaks on the floor within 4 weeks of becoming a senator because he has an amendment to this Appalachian bill, this aid package. And the senator, I believe William Jennings Randolph was a senator from West Virginia who had shepherded the bill, who'd been the sponsor and everything. When the bill passes, Robert Kennedy is on the front page, a picture of him on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, not Randolph. And so that just goes to show how he could completely outshine no matter what seniority was, and that it was a little bit more of a his power in the Senate didn't really come through legislating, though he was an able legislator and he did have some concrete accomplishments compared to what, you know, some people who we consider successful in politics today. He, though, realized early on that his power was to get up on the Senate floor and talk and to go out and give speeches and talk. And that's really how he moved the needle.
And yet you make it clear that he's not trying to be an out-and-out show horse. He's walking a fine line because you describe how he's setting up his Senate office and he's trying to avoid being seen as though he is, you know, somehow becoming too self-aggrandizing. He's trying to be modest in his setup, even though he, as you described, they were getting 1,000 letters from people a day, and it was overwhelming the ability of their you know, small staff to deal with it. But he's very conscious that, you know, while on the one hand he is going to use his strengths, at the same time he can't get too carried away. Otherwise, you know, he has to, in essence, pace himself.
Right. He walks back some of the things that his predecessor, Kenneth Keating, had done. He stopped doing a news program on television. He actually didn't do a national interview for the first year, a nationally televised interview for the first year of his time in the Senate. He recognizes that he's got to make the people feel comfortable in the Senate. He takes a seat on a less than desirable committee, the District of Columbia Committee, which was charged with overseeing the city, the capital city. And he attends his hearings, and he takes them seriously, and he does his homework, and he actually does make some difference. And the other fact too is that because so many people were watching him in those hearings, he imbued him with some sort of importance at times, where people were much more interested to see how he interacted with the witnesses. And George McGovern, and it was sort of true for both Kennedy brothers at the time. George McGovern gave a speech alongside Teddy Kennedy around this time. And as Teddy spoke first and concluded, the gallery emptied out, and the press gallery emptied out. And so there was poor George McGovern speaking to an empty Senate. And he was asked about it, and he said, "Well, you know, I'm glad that they're using him for important issues." So there was some trade-off that he could get out of having that power and that celebrity, but clearly he tried to his best to keep it in check. But there was only so much they could do. They left the door open at the Senate office so that people couldn't see the name on the door and come in looking for autographs. So that was how his staff dealt with it.
The service in the Senate that I thought was most interesting was his service on the Health and Labor Committee. Because there you have a issue an area which on the surface he has no association. I mean, he's a former attorney general of the United States. And yet, as you describe, his aides are saying, you shouldn't serve on the Judiciary Committee. He mm-hmm. could go for a high profile committee like, say, foreign relations. And yet he doesn't do that. So he goes on the Health and Labor Committee. And as you describe, it really does connect him with this issue, which is becoming much more prominent at the same time. And it helps in this revolution that is taking place in terms of his political standing.
Right. There were a couple of issues that he went through the Labor Committee, partially with education and partially with, I believe that was the committee through which he dealt with the veterans hospitals. As well, and I can't quite recall offhand which ones they sort of blend together for me, the committees. But this is where he first encountered Cesar Chavez in 1966 in some of these hearings on migratory labor in California, where he got to see these people who were protesting and trying to really do something incredibly difficult, which was strike a grape field, which was like someone the New Republic equated to striking a plant with hundreds of entrances that spanned acres and acres. How do you effectively picket something like that? And then also seeing how they were the sort of abuses of their rights. And their free speech, and how Robert Kennedy stood up for these people, and he was considered somewhat of a brutish guy, of a law enforcement backing guy. You know, he would literally say to these lawmen out in California to read the Constitution that, you know, I understand the pressures you are under as a former law enforcement official, but there are certain lines you cannot cross, and therefore you need to have compassion. You need to follow the law. And these were things that I think maybe he would not have had as up close and personal contact with as Attorney General working in Washington, varying between the Justice Department and the White House and his house in McLean, Virginia. Being in the Senate brought him closer to people who did not have power and who did not have the immediate levers of the executive branch, where he could pick up the phone and make and make an ask and make a request, and it would get done, that they had to work in concert with other legislators and also see how they could assist people who were trying to make change out in the streets and out in their communities. So in that case, that Robert Kennedy was able to see how people who did not have power coped, and was able to also try to convey to them that it's best to work through the system to try to change things using the existing means, instead of turning either cynical or turning violent, because there was also a lot of unrest in that period that unfortunately would get violent and not serve the change in the way that Robert Kennedy felt that you could make it happen. I mean, he was a person who really believed in collective action and in things that that there was power in the institutions, and that once people became discouraged, it was going to not be good, because there is the change was inevitable in this time period, and they had to find the best ways to handle it.
I think that approach really comes out in your book when you're describing his trip to South America, especially when he's in Chile and you describe his engagement with the communists. And these are people who most politicians would back away from, because they're throwing things at him, they're screaming at him, they're spitting on him, and yet he's trying to engage him. And it's an engagement that on one level is saying, this is a dialogue, this is the political process, work with me at this level, even though I disagree with you, let's do it at this. And it's very dramatic, considering that, he's dealing with communists who are very much, who are much more focused on having that dramatic engagement than in participating in that dialogue that he wants.
Yeah, and it wasn't just theater, too. That's the other thing, because sometimes people go to these events for fights, and sometimes people, suspected Robert Kennedy of doing things for as a gimmick. In Chile, at Concepcion, he tried to really have a dialogue with these students, because he was aware that there were going to be problems, that this was a place where communism was very strong. And he asked the communist students to come ahead of time to talk to him where he was staying. They sat across the table from each other. They had a very stern conversation. Robert Kennedy said to them, I'm not some sort of thug. I'm not going to have a Marine stick a bayonet in you. And I'm trying to have a conversation with you. I'll speak. You'll speak. We will all speak, and we will all be heard. And whoever's ideas are best are going to win. That's really what his philosophy was, and what he felt was he can convey to these students about democracy. And that's part of the revolution was to spread as sort of gospel that we should be having conversations, and that ideas, it should be a battle of ideas, and let that be the winner. And so, yeah, he goes and speaks, even though he's being dissuaded, even though they don't allow police protection they don't allow police on these campuses as what the local custom was. He goes anyway, and they're throwing rocks, they're spitting at him, they're throwing eggs. He does comment that they didn't have very good aim because they were hitting all of the people around him. And so Bill Vandenheuvel was covered in eggs, and Bobby was okay. But he goes right up. He tries to speak. He jumps on a table. He's speaking with an interpreter behind him, and he's just being shouted down the whole time. He finally goes over to try to. There is some violence. There's students are fighting with each other. The American flag is burned. Bobby goes over to try to speak to them directly. He goes. He even decides, I'm going to leave the stage. I'm going to leave the rostrum area. I'm going to go back there. And they literally spit in his face, and the spit streams down his face. And he turns and realizes, okay, well, we've done what we can here, and that's it. And so he goes. But it's still a victory for the students who wanted to have free speech, the students who believed in liberal democracy. And then right after that, he decides to go to the mines to see why communism is so strong in this area. And the mine overseers try to stop him. They try to send the elevators down. They try to send the rail cars out without him. And he literally chases them down and jumps into it so they could bring him down beneath the ocean to see what the conditions were like. And, you know, he says that this is the guy who would work for Joseph McCarthy, who is the great revolutionary in American history, says, you know, if I worked in these mines, I'd be a communist too. That's an amazing statement to think about a person's development after all that. So it was a genuine desire to have a dialogue, to let people speak to each other, and also to hear from people who disagreed with him and have people who disagreed with him to speak back to him. That's not something a lot of people in power are willing to subject themselves to, no.
You end the book with Kennedy's trip to South Africa and the delivery of his Ripple of Hope speech in 1966. But there is more of a foreshadowing of the future in how you address Robert Kennedy's growing engagement with the issue of Vietnam. And it's an issue which, on one level, he doesn't have the platform because he's not on the Foreign Relations Committee. But again, he's Robert Kennedy. And you describe how he is engaging with this issue, which is not as big as it's going to be in 1968, but is already of great concern to him.
Yeah, from the very beginning of the relationship between Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, Vietnam is a sticking point. Robert Kennedy believes that it's a political problem, not a military problem. And Lyndon Johnson sees a military problem with a political aspect to it. And even when they're discussing, you know, Robert Kennedy volunteers to go and serve as the envoy to Vietnam in June of 1964. Whether or not that was part of his ploy to make him to ingratiate himself with Lyndon Johnson as a loyal servant is one questionable aspect. I'm not quite certain why he volunteered in the end. I'm sure if Johnson had decided to send him, he would have gone. There was also a suggestion that he wanted to serve as a serve in Vietnam and then come back and take a higher position in the State Department, and that was his sort of way of going about doing that. But he is having these conversations with LBJ from May of 1964 through 1965 until 1966. In about February, the Fulbright hearings happen, and the war is getting worse. They're ramping up. Johnson is beginning to experience this thing called, for the first time by a columnist in the Washington Post, a credibility gap, in which people are becoming cynical about the administration's statements about what's happening. The Fulbright hearings, though, happen, and Dean Rusk testifies about elections in Vietnam. And Robert Kennedy had been very much a proponent of holding an election in which the National Liberation Front was able to take part and potentially win some power. And now there was this is a very controversial idea. In some ways, it's like letting a terrorist organization take part in a democratic country's elections, even though you can really call South Vietnam a very democratic country at that point. But the idea was that, you know, you can't let communists into the democratic system because they rig it in their favor and then they take over. And they had seen that happen in Europe not long before. But Robert Kennedy hears Dean Rusk testify saying that we should have elections. He decides to make a statement. And so he makes a statement in the Senate caucus room. He basically saying, give them a share of the power and responsibility. And we can't ask for total. If we ask them not, you know, for anything not that doesn't involve participating in elections, we're really just asking them for total surrender and that we're fighting a war with a really impossible goal in mind. And in that case, he flies out to Vermont for the weekend with Ethel and the kids, and there's firestorm rains down on him, in which the people who he had served with in his brother's cabinet are all criticizing him. The vice president, overseas at the time, says that it's like letting the fox guard the hen house. And Robert Kennedy hadn't realized how controversial the statement was going to be. So he comes back and he has to have a press conference to explain his press conference, which is never a good thing. And and he realizes, I think, in that instance, that talking about Vietnam and talking about very sensitive issues in which Johnson is struggling in a very real sense, it's different than disagreeing with him on some sort of health policy or different place, that it's too politically disruptive, and that people immediately reduced it to a personality issue, and that Robert Kennedy didn't like Lyndon Johnson, therefore he didn't like his Vietnam policy. Not that he genuinely held these beliefs. So therefore, Robert Kennedy retreated from those issues. And I actually, I haven't gone too deep in my research into his life in 67 and 68, so I don't want to say definitively. But if you ask me, it seems that the seeds of his hesitancy to get into the presidential race in late 1967 and early 1968, I believe, are planted from the reaction to that statement he gave in 1966.
Very much at this point, a decision to run for the presidency that is born of his own political experience and not as a matter of carrying his brother's torch.
Yes, I think if he had been thinking about protecting the Kennedy legacy and not about what was happening in the country, he would have sat tight for 1972 or a later date, because he was still a very young man. I think he saw what was happening with Vietnam, and he felt that, well, if I don't step forward now, as so many people have asked me to, and as so many people who've asked me have gone off to work for Eugene McCarthy, the senator from Minnesota, who got in the race when Bobby wouldn't, that I'm going to lose my identity, and I can't honestly say I'm going to support Lyndon Johnson, and I can't say that I'm neutral, because he also really didn't have much respect for McCarthy. So that's, I think, really, yeah, why he got into it and how he went on. It wasn't about JFK's legacy so much, and which is, again, the revolution of Robert Kennedy. JFK's legacy is no longer the supreme thing, the only guiding force.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I'm thinking about some local crime stories about Jersey City, New Jersey, a bookie who looked like a bum. But that's really all I can say, because I haven't done as much research as I want to yet.
I hope that it turns out to be a very fruitful source of material for a future book. John Bohr, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much, Mark. I really appreciated it.